Morning. I'm Ken Lieberthal. I'm director of the John L. Thornton China Center at Brookings. Delighted to welcome you here to this morning's program on China's new talent policy in a global context. Let me make a few remarks just to kind of tee up the morning, and then I'll ask Cheng Li and the speakers to come forward. Seems to me it's a truism that national competition for talent will be a major factor in determining national competitiveness in the coming years. The high value-added parts of the global supply chain are populated by educated, highly innovative people. Innovation itself has accelerated dramatically in recent decades by every measure. And now a large percentage of the most richly rewarded jobs as of 2010 did not exist as a job as of 2000. So the very character of job opportunity is changing in dramatic fashion. Whole new industries are being developed around completely new types of products, and this is happening at speeds that are historically unprecedented. And the capacity to conceptualize and design whole new types of products by leveraging new capabilities that have been produced in various niches, cutting-edge technology breakthroughs here, here, and here, where you conceptualize how to put those capabilities into a new product and then design that product, produce and market it, and that kind of thing, is critical to future national economic vitality. And all of that obviously requires an abundance of educated talent to do well in that kind of environment. But it seems to me there's also an underlying tension here, and that is that science and business have never before been so international, in fact, transnational. Fewer major companies limit their advanced R&D to one locality. Many major companies have a series of their cutting-edge technology centers around the world, and they literally hand off a problem to each other over the course of a 24-hour period to work on, or break up one problem into different segments and assign it to different R&D centers that then combine and recombine as they work through the issue. Information is being shared globally in ways that are utterly revolutionary. This is not only the information on the web and that kind of thing, but also, frankly, given the real world of cybersecurity insecurity, it includes the most highly proprietary information that companies and governments hold. So we now have national prosperity increasingly depending on what appear to be inherently transnational processes in an environment in which the most competitive players understand how best to leverage knowledge and capability everywhere in the world. But at the same time, we have major governmental players seeking to impose national plans and national boundaries to increase their own people's global competitiveness. That is nowhere more true among major players than in China. But many others are also making efforts to some extent, and there I would certainly include India. Now let me add to the mix a factor that is important everywhere, but especially for India and China. And that is these are two countries with very large, extremely talented, well-educated diasporas, nationals who live abroad. And that adds in the question of personal mobility. Is it possible as a national strategy to attract back citizens educated abroad and to have them spearhead national innovation policies and strategies? Can this achieve sufficient support among those who have made new lives abroad? Can this be sustained politically at home? There are two dimensions to that, it seems to me, at a minimum. One, that the people who have spent years abroad have developed new ideas, styles, and habits that may not fit very comfortably when they go back home. And then secondly, those who have not had the opportunity to spend those years abroad may experience jealousies, and there may be other understandable factors that make the environment back at home less welcoming than the national governments would like it to be. And let me add, since this is the Brookings Institution and all of this, how should the United States act? America has traditionally benefited enormously from its ability to attract the top young and middle-aged talent from elsewhere and give people opportunities in our very open society to realize their full potential to their benefit and to America's benefit. But recent American policies have seemed to move in a different direction. And China and India are seeking to take full advantage of that reality. So our topic today, it seems to me, is multidimensional, complex, subtle, and extraordinarily important. I'm delighted that the Thornton Center today has the opportunity to host a panel discussion of this critical issue, and that we've drawn top talent both from and about China, India, and the United States to lead this discussion. The focus of the discussion is China in a global context, but we have a full panoply of expertise here to put it in proper context. With that as background and just to kind of get you thinking about the issue, I want to turn over to the program to our Director of Research, Li Cheng, who will then introduce the program and speakers.
Yeah. Cheng. Well, thank you, Ken. I know that you are leaving for another event. And he gave us a very comprehensive and, in my view, balanced view of this very important subject. Now, I'm Cheng Li, and I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings. First, I would like to join Ken in welcoming you all to this panel discussion, China's New Talent Policy in a Global Context. China's economic rise has been a fascinating development, and to a certain extent, a big surprise in global affairs. Less noted, but equally intriguing, are the country's unremitting efforts to train, recruit, and cultivate global talent. We have many PRC students and scholars in the audience today. Many of you probably have seen the 2005 popular Chinese movie called A World Without Thieves. 天下无贼, A World Without Thieves. Very good film. For those of you who haven't seen, you can order, you know, online and has English title. Now, there's a famous question raised by the master of an underworld gang. He asked, I quote, "What is the most precious essence in the 21st century?" The answer, of course, is talent, 人才. Now, for the past three decades, the Chinese leadership has appeared to recognize readily the pivotal role of human capital in enhancing China's national competitiveness. Deng Xiaoping's decision to send a large number of Chinese students to study in the West, Jiang Zemin's embrace for the leading role of technocrats and entrepreneurs in China's economic takeoff, and Hu Jintao's use of both techno-nationalism and physical capital to reverse the trend from brand drain to brand gain, all profoundly contribute to China's rise on the world stage. Now, other developing countries, most notably India, have also greatly benefited from the two-way process of international flow of human capital and have attracted global talent as a means of fostering innovation and building internationally competitive industries. These developments have raised many important questions, and Ken early on mentioned some, listed some of the questions. I want to add a few more. Has the global landscape of human capital begun to shift in favor of the emerging power? What are the relative strengths and weaknesses among countries such as China, India, and the United States in terms of cultivation of global talent and economic innovation? Should the international competition for human resources be seen as a zero-sum game? Can educational exchange have a spillover effect, namely contributing to the dissemination of international norms, mutual understanding, and cooperation in various other areas? Now, these inquiries are also closely related to some major debates in the United States regarding America's own open-door policy, immigration reforms, U.S. policy towards China, and American leadership in the 21st century. Now, this morning, we are fortunate to have three prominent scholars to present their expert analysis and diverging perspectives on this important and very timely subject. Their bios are included in the program handout, so I don't need to repeat their long list of accomplishments, and each of them, in fact, published numerous books, you know, in case of Wang Huiyao, probably 30 books, you know, in Chinese. Now, instead, I just want to say a few words for each of them. Dr. Wang Huiyao currently a visiting scholar at the Brookings China Center, is Director General of the Center for China and Globalization, a major think tank based in Beijing. He has substantially involved in China's strategic thinking on human resources development. He just got back from a brief trip to Beijing just 2 days ago, right, where he briefed senior leaders and also offered a three-hour-long seminar for directors of the organization departments of China's 31 provincial party committees. As we know, that the organization department is the most powerful institution in China. He briefed these 31 top leaders in each and every provinces. Now, I hope that you told them that Brookings is the number one think tank in the world, and they should serve our Chinese website every day. Now, Professor Dennis Fred Simon is a professor at the Pennsylvania State University. Professor Simon recently also served as provost and vice president for academic affairs at Sony's Levin Graduate Institute of International Relations and Commerce. Actually, he has a reputation as a dean of the technology issues in China, in the field of technology in China. Really, it's the most important figure in that area. A leading scholar in the world on China's technology development, he has profoundly transformed our understanding of the role of technology and the human capital in China's transformation, and also the major challenges that China faces in the years to come. Last but not least, Devish Kapoor is the director of the Center for the Advanced Study of India at the University of Pennsylvania. Born and bred in India, he received his PhD from Princeton, the best university in the U.S., in my view, and taught at Harvard, the second or third best university in the United States, I would say. Also worked at the Brookings for 7 years in the 1990s, so welcome back. And he will provide a much-needed comparative perspective based on his expertise in talent migration in both China and the United States. Now, each panelist will have 15 to 20 minutes remark, and we will have a Q&A session following their presentations. But before that, at the recommendation of Professor Simon, we will see a 3 minutes long video, and I think released by China's Xinhua or Beijing Review.
CCTV,
yeah. So we have the crew from CCTV, so you will be very happy to see a program in 3 minutes in English, and then we will have Wang Huiyao to speak about the China's national program. And thank you very much. Again, thank you for coming in this morning. Yeah.
China has been cultivating talent as the nation's strategy. The government has issued a medium and long-term talent development plan, which sets a blueprint for creating a highly skilled national workforce in the next 10 years. But we can China have the details.
Sun Zhenyou is the chief designer of China's sophisticated lunar exploration program. In his design team, many participants are under the age of 35. Despite their relatively young age, for their field of expertise, they receive plenty of training.
The title of the position of Deputy General Designer of the Chinese Lunar Exploration Program, I was sent to attend a two general training program in which I learned related professional knowledge and experience.
The two general training programs for general designers and managers of major projects. China also invited senior experts for consultation and enhanced international communication on different technological problems. It has realized the goal of developing talent while progressing with this project.
This team is young, but after they graduated from college, they have been developing steadily as a well-planned space program progresses. When the rocket module is finished, our whole team improves, not just an individual person.
Cultivating a group of world-class scientists and building an independent, innovative country has been one of China's national strategies. China released a medium and long-term talent development plan which aims to increase the number of research and development personnel to 4 million by 2020.
如果我们中国能够很好地看到这样的cultivating talent, China will no longer just be the world factory. It will be the world's research and development lab and the major country of producing knowledge.
China has the world's largest population and now it wants to be the biggest pool for scholars. The government released the talent development plan as a policy to ensure cultivating and attracting talent is a system that cannot be ignored.
做了这样的新规, the talent development plan aims to create an environment in which everyone can be trained into talented people who have contributed their wisdom to the development of the country. This will provide a strong backup for China's scientific development and modernization. The central government made this plan up for country's long-term development strategy called the strategy of reintegrating China through human resource development.
The plan lists six major categories of talents that a government will help cultivate, ranging from political leaders, entrepreneurs, to high-tech researchers and professional social workers. The government will also conduct large-scale training programs to encourage more college graduates to work in China's rural areas to help local farmers to live a better life.
According to the outline, talent refers to people with professional knowledge and special skill, and more importantly, those who are able to do creative work. Over the next 10 years, China is hoping to see a large number of talents and innovative outputs. These offer an immense and a reputation for cheap labor and Shanghai products.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks, Ken, and also Chen's introductory remarks, and also welcome all of you today. Just now you saw the little clip of China Talent Plan actually recently announced, and so I'm very pleased today to give a bit more elaboration on that. So I have prepared a PPT on the China Talent Plan. And I think this is a very important plan to really lead China into the next 10 to 20 years of major development. Actually, since China opened for the last 30 years, China is really looking for ways of how to continue to keep the momentum to develop. So what I would like to do first, I would like to give a bit brief of the background of this talent plan. And then also I'm going to give some highlights of the plan and also some analysis. Now, the plan background. I actually identified five transformations that is going to happen in China, and this all related to the talent plan. The first is the from the population dividend to the talent dividend. As we know that China is really, for the last 30 years, thriving on the labor, yeah, a lot of 225 million migrant workers. That is the backbone of China's development for the last 30 years. And then another thing is China has a fast aging population. And by now, it already have 168 million people over the age of 60. And another thing that really staggering is China has about 98 million college students right now in China among the working population. And this is actually going to be increased by 2020 to almost 200 million. So imagine we have a 225 million migrant workers now, and then in 10 years' time, China is going to have 200 million college graduates. So what that implicate to the government and also to the society transformation is enormous. So China has to face this enormous challenge. The second trend, actually, I can see is the China is heavily made in China for the last 30 years. It's become the world manufacturing center. And that is going to transform into created in China. So this is actually is happening very fast. But made in China, China is really have all done well. I mean, that has no problem. But then they have a serious challenges that they have no branding. There's no major international active firm. Out of the top 100 firms in China, probably there's only one active internationally, that is Huawei, and all the rest is really not well known. And also labor cost is on the rising side. We saw that there's quite a number of strikes and even suicides in the Chinese manufacturing sectors of those cheap labor. And also that we have a high environmental cost and also resources cost. China is the number one consumption of the steel, cement, and all the rest. Yet the government goal is to change China into an innovative and creative country by 2020. So there's a daunting task of making this made in China to create in China, and that also related with talent. And then the third trend that I'm identifying here is for the last 30 years, China basically was really attracting foreign capital. Zhao Shang Yin Zi is the major theme for China. And this is going to change from now on, from attracting financial capital to attaining human capital. So China actually is the top FDI country, and we have about 2.4 trillion foreign exchange reserve, the largest in the world. And then China has now 1.6 million students sent overseas since China opened up. But of today, it's only about less than 500,000 return. So you can see the return ratio is less than 30%. And even more alarming is the science and engineering PhD graduates in the U.S. According to the latest statistics, the returning rate is only 8%, which means the high-level talents are not really returning. So that is actually another task relating with talent. And also from the hardware to software is the number four transformation. China has a very impressive hardware infrastructure. We can see from Three Gorges Dams to high-speed railways and from Olympic Stadium to Expo Pavilion. But yet China lacks the investment in education, R&D, public health, energy consumption, conservation, environment protection, institution building, social welfare, etc. So there's many, many areas that really need people to do it, just not the hardware. So we're really looking at the software issues and also related with talent. And the final trend is really you have to see that China is heavily in the investment-driven environment for the last 30 years. So from environment-driven economy to talent-driven economy is really the key for China's a series of issues. Raise the consumption level, raise the wages of the workers, and also to create better jobs, and also to depend less on the export. So all those has to be really changing the paradigm of heavily related on the investment, and also more on the human talents. Now I'm coming to the second point of this morning's presentation, which is the development of talent plan. So that's where we come from. So you have this five background of transformation, and then it's high time for China to really look at talent development. But the talent development plan actually comes from quite a bit of a background. So in 2001, there's an APEC conference, and 2002, there's a national talent meeting building plan, and conference on that, and also the important thing is they established a central talent work coordinated group headed by Li Yuanchao, the minister and the Politburo member. And this is the talent group above all the ministry level. It's composed of a number of high-level ministries. And then in 2007, the party actually adopted a talent development plan as a strategy to revitalize the country. They call it in Chinese, 人才强国战略. So that is really also worth noting is that they have written that into the party congress report and also writing into the party constitution for that strategy policy, talent strategy policy. And actually, with all those preparation in 2008, when Li Yuanchao became the party bureau member and also minister of organization of department, he placed this work on top of his agenda. And then we see immediately this plan is in the making. and there was a large number of work involved. I was actually involved in this drafting of this plan, and you can see 42 reports and 161 sub-reports, and involving 500 meetings and involving 30,000 people across the country. So this plan was actually quite well debated and discussed, and received over 1,000 comments and revision ideas. So in the end, by 2010, which is this year, this this plan is actually approved by all the Politburo members for twice the meeting on that. So this year, on May 25 to 26, there's a very unusual meeting held in China, which all 9 Politburo members have attended, and so they passed this national talent development plan. And also, this conference was televised live and attended by all the 30 provincial governors and the party leaders throughout the country. And this is very unusual to have such a large meeting on this particular plan, and had 2 days for this conference. Now, some of the major indicators of this plan, we can just have a quick look. And so the number of total talents currently is about 140 million, and then by 2020 is going to be 180 million. So they have the government has a very ambitious plan to increase the talent pool of China. And also the R&D of the in the workforce, by 2020 there should be 43 people that concentrate the R&D in population of per 1,000. And also scale of the ratio of high skilled talents will also be increased from 24% to 28% by 2020. And also ratio of the labor force in the who has a higher education will be increased from currently 9.2% to 20% by 2020. And then another thing is the ratio of human capital investment of the GDP will be currently about 10% to raise to that to 15% by 2020. So all those major task has been stipulated in the plan. And this is actually, you can see that this is a plan with some concrete numbers and detailed planning. And that really means that China is going to do a lot of things to match this plan, to achieve this plan. Now, I want to have some highlights of the plan and give some analysis on that. I think this plan actually first established a national talent development targets. And this is for the first time in the People's Republic of history that ever have a plan to establish talents. So the objective of the plan is to transform China with the largest population into a stronger human resource country. So the talent pool will be increased from 114 million to 180 million, and of course the ratio of education, as I just mentioned, from currently 9.2% to 20%. And also the second thing is there's a 6 categories that has been identified, which included that as a priority of talent, including political leaders and officials, business entrepreneurs, technical professionals, highly skilled talents, practical talents for rural area and agriculture, and professional social workers. So you can see that even the first time they have added the professional social workers into the talent category, which was in the past was not really a category. So those are the areas that are going to concentrate and develop. And then the emphasis of the quality and the selection process of officials. And by 2020, more than 85% of all government employees will have 4 years college education. So this means that in the future, if you want to work in the government, you have to have a better education that in order to increase the efficiency and the effectiveness. And also the plans call to break away from restriction and the limitation from the Chinese government entities and to work units for talent flow, which means you can really come in from other backgrounds, and this calls for an open environment for utilizing talents. In the past, it's only officials was drawn from the university graduates and then all the way up, but now they can draw from a talent flow. Also, the government need to widen the channels to recruit the talent individuals, to improve the system and also to be the hired, the officials to be hired from various enterprises, institutions, and organizations. And this is also a major change, because in the past, the government seldom does the hiring from the society, from the market. And then number four is that there is a number of talents has been specified in the categories of technologies, science, and all those areas. So there's going to be a 5 million of those professionals that will be needed in those categories that I don't want to go into in detail. And then there's about in the next 10 years, more than 8 million professionals will be in the fields of education, political science and law, medicine, health, public, and information, and disaster prevention. And more college graduates will work in the China rural areas to help local governments. And then they will have 3 million professional social workers by 2020. So you can see these all have concrete numbers. The number five is also they're going to have some program to support more talented culture and scholar figures. For example, that they're going to spend more money on that, and then they're going to support 2,000 scholars by 2020 and with the funding of the government. And prioritize R&D sectors. In the plan, they also specify that R&D professionals will be 3.8 million by 2020. And this is a very large number of people that specialize in R&D. You can compare that in Germany, you have only 280,000, France, 200,000, United Kingdom, 170,000, and even the U.S. is only 600,000. So China is going to have 3.8 million R&D professionals by 2020, and this is an enormous increase and a very ambitious plan. And China national R&D spending will increase from currently 1.6% to 2.5% by 2020. So this is going to be a very large addition. And also national educational budget will be increased from currently 4% in 2 years' time to currently it's about 2 to 3% to 4% by 2012. And not only that, they also place a lot of emphasis on the business entrepreneur leaders. For example, they're going to train or cultivate around 100 business leaders and CEOs who can lead Chinese firms getting to the rank of Fortune 500 companies by 2020. So this is another ambitious plan that China wants to get more active in the business field. And also, those business knowledgeable talents working for SOE will be internationally related will increase to 40,000 people, and with 50% of them hired through the market competition. And China will also recruit globally for some key top positions for SOEs, state-owned enterprise. Actually, that is already happening in the past, but China is going to increasingly emphasize more on that, and then with more opening and more recruitment. One of the interesting that Chinese citizenship is no longer required in hiring some of the top management positions. So this is really another breakthrough. And then recently there is a high profile recruitment of Zhang Hongli, who was the China operational chairman for Deutsche Bank, and directly hired him to the Commercial Bank of China, which is the largest bank in China, also the largest, one of the largest in the world. So this has actually happened the first time. For Mr. Zhang, never worked in a day in the Chinese government or state-owned enterprises, directly parachuted from a foreign bank into a Chinese bank as a VP, and this is unprecedented. And also, the most noticeable, actually, in this plan, and has been widely reported, is this Thousand Talent Plan that China has announced. Basically, the Thousand Talent Plan calls for China to attract 2,000 high-level overseas talents to work in China in the next 5 to 10 years. So this is involving people in the science, technology, entrepreneurial, and management. And by May of 2010, over 600 people has already been attracted under the program, including some foreigners, Caucasians, or people from different countries. And 80% of them actually are foreign passport holders or foreign nationals. Of course, most of them originally from China, but this program is not limited to the diaspora, but also to Westerners. And one of the interesting cases is that 300 of them actually was enrolled in the training courses given by various ministers, including Minister Li Yuanqiao, at the Central Party School in Beijing. So you can imagine that party school used to train top government officials, now starting to train foreign nationals coming back from different countries. And actually, China also now, in addition to the Southern Talent Program, they attract some short-term experts to work in China. According to the China Foreign Experts Bureau, last year there's about almost half a million people from overseas, professional from overseas, experts worked in China on the short term. And then you can see that the Southern Talent Program is really getting a lot of attention, and the Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping met a representative of the Southern Talent Program and gave them very royal treatment and met them in Beidaihe Summer Resort just this July. And so they have received a lot of attention and a lot of support for those highly skilled talents. Not only that, with those programs, but there are also some policies to back those programs. For example, in this talent plan, China actually indicated the Chinese government wants to improve its permanent foreign resident system, so-called green card. Because in 2003, China has actually announced its permanent green card system, but it was really only aimed at people who were already in China for living there for a number of years. For example, I met a reporter working for China Radio International here, and he wants to apply the green card, but he has to live in China consecutively for 4 years. But every year he took a vacation, and then not count. So he had to calculate again to accumulate 4 years' time. So that system is very rigid. That was not really working, and China is going to change that and improve that. And not only that, it's also trying to exploit the adaptation of the policy as technical skill immigrants, because in China there's no immigration bureau right now, and China could possibly set up an immigration bureau and to tackle that. And also you can see that in China there's only 223,000 foreign working in China with employment permits, and that is far less than what actually China wanted. So you have to increase better system. And the plan also calls for more foreign students to study in China. And currently there's about 200,000 foreign students studying in China, compared with over 1.2 million Chinese students studying in foreign countries. So there's a huge imbalance of attracting foreign students to study in China. And Obama actually announced the U.S. going to send 100,000 students to China, and this is probably going to help in this regard. And also, China is going to send more talents to work for international institutions, like the example of Justin Lin, who is now the World Bank senior economist, and Zhu Min, now the special advisor to IMF. Actually, by the end of 2009, there is already over 1,000 Chinese professionals working in different international organizations. So this is going to be more in the future, that more Chinese will coming out working for international organizations. And then another highlight I would like to present is in this plan, they also calls for set up talent reform zones, management reform zones. So that actually is going to happen in the future as well. Now, some final thoughts. So talent as a national plan is to really to transform China from a labor-intensive to a talent-rich by 2020. And this is really a very ambitious objective. And now we can see that the cheap labor has fueled China development over the past three decades, but that model, filled with mainly with manufacturing, high resources and energy consumption and heavy pollution on the environment, has led China to a crossroad. So 30 years is a good time to pondering to really see what's the next 30 years and what will be driving China for the next 30 years. And this talent plan actually serves as a new initiative and a new strategy. So they have found a new growth engine and a new effective stimulus to build China into an innovative and sustainable country, but there still remains major challenges ahead, even for this talent plan. For example, one of the challenges I see is the education reform. So if China is not going to reform the education, this talent creation and talent cultivation will still be in big problem. So even though there's a good plan, but I think we still need to catch up with other fronts. So we see major challenges ahead on that as well. And finally, while China's past success was mainly built on its population dividend and investment, its future growth will rely more on the new talent strategy by better utilizing the talents in China and also attract talents from all over the world. So I think this is my analysis and citations of this plan, and I would like to get more on that later in the discussion. So thank you very much.
To be on the desktop, but it is. Okay, very good. Well, again, thank you all for coming this morning, and it's a great opportunity, I think, for us to get some deep insights into what is going on in China's talent situation. If you recall, over the last 10 years, at least in the United States, if not more, we've been engaged in a debate about whether or not we have a sufficient number of scientists or technologists, or whether our education system is producing enough people. We can see studies from the National Academy of Sciences, the National Science Foundation, all of which have sort of started to scare Americans that we simply don't have enough people who are interested in science and engineering. At the same time that this debate was going on, particularly around 2003, 2004, there started to be a great concern that all of a sudden about this explosion in the number of Chinese engineers that were being trained in China, and it seemed that Chinese engineers were going to take over the world. In fact, there was growing concern in the United States that China simply, if there was a Sputnik problem, you know, with the Russians back in the 50s and 60s, there was going to be a big problem with China in terms of simply the number of engineers they were able to train. But all of a sudden, as I started to visit China, particularly I visit China about five or six times a year, work a lot with American multinationals, Chinese organizations, people started talking about something called a talent shortage. And it was a great surprise. You see all these booming statistics and all this data about the numbers of people that are being trained in Chinese universities, and yet on the ground, talk to Chinese enterprise managers, talk to R&D directors, talk to multinational CEOs in China, people talking about talent shortage. So how is this possible that there's a talent shortage in China, given all the huge numbers of people that are being trained and being put out by universities? And so that became kind of the driver for a book project that I did with a colleague, Cao Tsung, that now has come out in a book with Cambridge University Press called China's Emerging Technological Edge, which has started to look at this question about why is there a talent shortage in China? So let me kind of talk to you about that and give you what I think is kind of the underlying dynamics of what has actually led the Chinese leadership to produce this very, very important and very strategic talent plan. So as Ken Lieberthal suggested, we are entering, we've entered already a new period of competition in the world economy, and now we no longer talk about, you know, kind of physical war. Now we're talking about competitive wars. Those wars are built around technology, intellectual property, patents, standards, and increasingly they're built around talent wars. And in fact, if you go to China today, people will in fact talk about the existence of a talent war. I would commend to you a book by Hagel and Brown called The Only Sustainable Edge. It came out a few years ago, in which they suggest that if you look at the last sentence in particular, not only this is about economics or is it about traditional natural resources, but the value of these resources and markets will increasingly be shaped by the relative success in building comparative advantage in talent markets. That the new international competition of the 21st century, has been suggested, is going to be built around talent. And Heidrick and Struggles, which is a big headhunter, in fact, all the headhunters in China now are talking about, in effect, the recruitment of high-end talent. Their clientele don't only include multinational companies, but increasingly include Chinese companies like Huawei, Lenovo, Haier, and other major Chinese enterprises that are now interested in tapping into the global talent pool in order to enhance their long-term competitive advantage. Now, as Professor Wong talked about, in 2003, I think December 2003, there was a very, very important conference held in Beijing in which Hu Jintao made a major speech in which he talked about the role, the critical role of competition. I think that, you know, with the resuscitation of the role of intellectuals in the late 70s, I think we made an assumption that everything was pretty much hunky-dory for intellectuals, and this red versus expert kind of argument that was so much a part of the Chinese political landscape had escaped. But yet, if we realize in 2003, China was still debating in many ways what should be the role of talent and what should be the role of intellectuals, what kind of position should they have in the society, what kind of trust should they be given. These were all big questions that had not been clearly established. And I think the 2003 meeting tried to set in motion a number of not only economic forces but also political forces to change that dynamic. And that brought us all the way up till today when just this summer, Li Yuanqiao, who had, as Professor Wong suggested, presided over this big national talent conference and the talent plan talked about, in effect, the need to really push very, very hard, not only on the 1,000-person program, which is very, very critical, but there's another sentence in here I think that's even more important. We must overhaul the mechanism and create an environment to enable talented people to succeed, which will in itself become the key to attracting employing in even more talented people. So we have a problem in the Chinese setting, and that is that why is there a talent problem? Why should there be a talent problem in a country with 1.3 billion people, with an education system that's producing so many people, and an economy that just simply is booming beyond imagination? Why should there be a problem? I think part of it is that simply just we are faced with a major dilemma of what do we mean when we talk about talent? Who is talent? What is talent? So when we did our study, one of the first things that we began to look at is that what is the nomenclature, what is the classification system that people are using when they describe literally how many scientists are there, how many engineers, who is an engineer, what is the equivalent of an engineer? One of the first things we began to realize is that the classification system, particularly that is used in China, does not accord very well with some of the established classification systems used in OECD. The Frascati method, the Canberra manual, these are all established international benchmarks for how do you rank, classify, and categorize people in terms of how their time is spent. And if you look at the chart up here, basically, the phrases S&T workers or S&T human resources, S&T personnel, R&D personnel in terms of full-time equivalents, these are all different categories of people. And depending on how we use these numbers and how we use these categories of people will tell us either there's just a humongous number of people in China that are in science and engineering or basically there's a very limited number. And so we focused our study on the right side of looking at scientists and engineers or scientists and engineers who are engaged in R&D, and that is people who have at least a four-year bachelor's degree or have at least a medium-level professional title because they may have been given that title before they were able to get a degree, and so they are, in a sense, a certain stature in terms of their education, background, and training. And a lot of you will know that in China, there is a category of people called zhuangke. Zhuangke are graduates that basically go to what might be two-year or three-year programs. They come out, and they can be classified as engineers, but the reality is that they actually don't meet the criteria for the kind of training that a 4 or 5 year engineer would get at Tsinghua, Tsinghua's full program, or at MIT here in the United States, or the equivalent somewhere in Europe. So we want to be very, very careful about this. So there are many, many problems in sense with when we use this term talent. What does talent mean? It's a very ambiguous term, I would argue. The Chinese definitions of their categories of people, as I said, don't accord well with the OECD indicators. We also know that talent, and I listened to Professor Wong's remarks quite closely, talent does not necessarily have the same meaning as, for example, when Richard Florida, who's written about the creative class in the United States, uses. I don't think the Chinese are using it in that same kind of term, in terms of the kind of people that we give a liberal arts education to, and they kind of become worldly in terms of their knowledge. They become able to be problem solvers, and most important, they're able to think out of the box because they are very creative kind of individuals. Talent has a very specific meaning in China, and that is that people, in the sense, who can enter the workforce and basically become employable. So data regarding, in a sense, the graduates that leave universities in China is also very, very problematic. It's very unreliable, and there's a lot of incentive to falsify data. And the incentive to falsify data really comes from the fact that people want to show that their graduates, in fact, are doing well in the labor market. But the reality is that many of these people actually don't have jobs. Their data has been falsified. The documentation that they're able to produce has been falsified. And there are some very, very serious problems, even to the point in which people can hack into the database of alumni in universities and put people's names onto those alumni lists to make it seem that they've actually graduated from those universities. So there are some very, very serious problems about fraudulent documentation out there. And so a lot of these numbers are unreliable. Even the numbers about returnees are unreliable. And they're unreliable basically because, in many cases, there are lots of deals that are made for people to assume the role of Changjiang visiting professor and other kinds of professors. They don't spend the time there that they're supposed to spend. There are all sorts of official requirements, and then there are also all sorts of local deals that are struck. It's not meant to be a criticism. It's a system that's evolving and maturing. And hopefully what this major new talent plan is designed to do is to crack down on that and to give some sense of reality to what the real talent situation is in China. So there are a number of critical issues surrounding this whole question about the talent pool. Will there be a shortage in China, or is there actually an oversupply? Recently, we read a lot of data about the fact that many, many college graduates actually can't find jobs in China. So again, how does this jive with the fact that people are complaining about talent shortages when, in fact, maybe as much as 25% of Chinese college graduates can't seem to find a job after they leave universities? Then there are some big broader questions out there about China's role in the global talent pool. Will China become a serious competitor in terms of global science and technology? And what does a more innovative China mean in particular for international science and technology progress of the world? I think these are all very, very important questions. So if we look at this, there are really three building blocks to what's going on in the talent domain. The 15 medium to long-term science and technology plan, which was announced in 2006, that is the driver, I would argue, for a lot of what's going on. That is the engine for producing this so-called innovative society that Chinese leaders now talk about. Then there's the recently announced medium to long-term education reform plan, which is designed to upgrade the quality of all schools in China, including increasing this budget to about 4%. And then there is now also the medium to long-term talent development plan, which is designed to deal specifically with meeting the requirements for the number of people that are needed. Now, I'll give you an example. In the 2006 background work that was done to produce the medium and long-term science and technology plan, there was a talent study that was done. The talent study only had a supply-side analysis. It didn't have any demand-side analysis. In other words, when they looked at this, they looked at what is the capacity of Chinese universities to produce output, but they didn't look at, in a sense, the changing dynamics of the Chinese economy and what was going to drive, in effect, this growing demand for talent in the economy over the next 10 to 20 years. And that is precisely the problem that we took on. We tried to understand, in a sense, where was the source of demand going to be from as China looked out into the future about how fast and how critical the talent supply could be met. Now, underlying this whole program right now today is the Organization Department of the Chinese Communist Party. Because when we look at talent, the Organization Department right now is front and center. It is the key organization. And if we look inside that organization, I did it by color, we can see three big red departments or bureaus in that department. This is a very secretive kind of department. We don't know everything that is going on, but under Li Yuanqiao, he has tried to open it up and give greater visibility to what the organization department is trying to do. But there is a Bureau on Human Talent Management now that has become very, very critical. There's a training center for cadres, and there's a Bureau on Cadre Education, all of which are going to help redesign and reconfigure what actually happens with the development and promotion processes for high-level cadres in China. This is very, very important because anyone professionally who moves up into the ranks of both the party organization and also in the state organization is going to have to go through a much more specific, much more well-defined set of performance criteria as they move up. So in other words, this is going to be less of a Guanxi-driven process, less of a relationship-driven process, and more of a kind of professionalism that the leadership hopes to move in place. Now, this all has to do with, in a sense, again, this whole supply-side perspective on what's going on in China. I looked at the figures in the talent plan that Professor Wang has showed. One of the things that we can never do is we can't discount what China says it's going to achieve into the future. I went down to visit Shenzhen in 1981. It was just a big hole in the mud. And they showed me a plastic model of what Shenzhen was going to look like in the future. It was going to be the second Hong Kong. And if you looked at that model and you looked at the mud on the ground, you said, no way. And in less than two decades, basically, we had a new Hong Kong. So I don't discount anything that is put on paper. I think a lot of it is achievable. I think there's just simply the will to do it is there in China. But the question is not one of quantity. The question is one of quality. And as we go out and look at this, what kind of people are being trained in China? That offers us some deep insight into whether or not China is going to meet this requirement for becoming an innovative society. So we can see the growth here in terms of both the numbers of scientists and engineers and also the numbers of scientists and engineers who are engaged in R&D. Again, very specific numbers, not talent, not S&T workers, but scientists and engineers who meet those educational criteria. So you can see the numbers are huge, but they're still modest in terms of some of the bigger numbers we've heard about. But the real revealing factor is that when you get to look at the numbers of scientists and engineers in R&D as a total number in absolute terms, China probably has now, if it hasn't exceeded the United States, is close to exceeding the United States. But in terms of its per capita, and that is the numbers of scientists and engineers in R&D on a full-time equivalent basis per 10,000 population, China still is a very, very small number compared to most of the other industrialized countries. So big numbers in absolute terms always going to be the case, but in relative comparative terms, China still is lacking in terms of the kind of people that it needs. And when we talk about scientists and engineers, let me remind you, this is not everyone becoming a biotech specialist or somebody becoming a semiconductor engineer. These are people who also are civil engineers, mechanical engineers. They build roads, they build bridges, they build dams, they build infrastructure. They're not only doing the kind of sexy things we associate with Silicon Valley, they are providing the fundamental skill sets that are needed to help drive the Chinese economy, both in terms of its foundation and also its cutting edge. Now, where did all of this come from? Where did all of these big numbers come from that we hear about in China? Well, in 1999, the Chinese government made a major decision, and that was to dramatically increase the enrollments in universities. Part of it had to do with employment considerations. Part of it had to do with considerations about getting a more educated population. So we can see the average annual growth of enrollments at the undergraduate and graduate levels basically doubled. And so we literally had a pouring into Chinese universities, larger and larger numbers of high school graduates. The question is, what happened to the number of faculty to teach them? And where did those faculty come from? And the expansion in the number of universities, what is the quality of those universities? So as we look down, we can look at China's top 20 universities, and these include the rankings from 2009, 2010. You can see there's a very great deal of homogeneity generally in terms of who are the top 20 universities in China. But once you get beyond those top 20 universities, the fall off is great. So I come from Penn State University. We're number 47. No big deal. Number 47 in the United States, pretty good. Not too bad. In fact, we probably can go all the way down to the first 100 universities in the United States and still feel fairly confident we're going to get a very good education. In China, once you leave these top 20 to 25 universities, the quality of the education starts to fall off precipitously, very suddenly and in a big way. And if you look at the kind of faculty that are being employed to teach all these added numbers of students, the faculty just simply aren't there in terms of quality. So if we look at some of the changes that are going on, it's very, very interesting. This is just from 2003 to 2008. We can see that the number of engineering students has actually declined in China from 37.8% of the total to about 31.7%, while the number of management students actually has increased. The number of law students also has increased. But when we look at these employment and unemployment issues, actually, at the end of the day, in 2009 and 2008, actually the largest categories of people who are finding it difficult to find employment are people in some of these same categories. Law, very difficult to find a job, even though some of these service areas are areas precisely where the Chinese government wants to expand. And this is just some data about management. You can see that people are getting MBAs. Even MBAs and some of the education, again, go to the top 10 schools for MBA in China, very, very good. Go to the next 50, the quality, again, falls off very, very precipitously and very sharply. It's not that there are too many MBAs in China. It's the poor quality of the training that these second-tier and third-tier universities provide to the students who are getting MBAs. So you've got all these numbers going into the system. The universities are able to have huge output. Why is it that there's this talent shortage again? So we began to do some analysis. So one of them was what we called the funnel analysis. In 2008, China actually graduated 1.84 million engineering graduates. So we began to do some analysis of what does that actually mean and what happened in the labor market. If you go down the line and you look at actually what that 1.84 million means, first of all, almost about half of those people are these Zhuangke students. That is, they're students with a two-year or three-year degree. They are not students with a four-year or five-year degree. In other words, they're not full-time equivalent engineering students. That means almost half the number falls off. These people are more like technicians than they are actually real engineers. You began to go through the number who go to graduate school in China, number who go to graduate school abroad, subtract those who are low quality, those who basically are mismatched in terms of where they want to be and what kind of job they get, and those that simply opt out and say, look, I don't want to be an engineer. I really don't. I want to work in the Marriott Hotel or whatever they want to do. That actually the number that falls out, and this is an updated number from our book, is about 20-22%. That is the number of really attractive people that are coming into the labor market that are really interesting, attractive, capable, et cetera, is only about 20 to 22%. Now, that's maybe a shocking number, but that is the reality of what goes on in China. And you can talk to enterprise managers, you can talk to R&D directors, and you can say, why aren't you hiring these young people? So if you look at the 2009 job market, again, you can look at these kind of problems. In 2007, almost 5 million college graduates, about 1.4 million couldn't find jobs. Only 25% of the new jobs that were made available in that year really were for college grads. According to the South China Morning Post, this past year, 2009, 68% of the 6.1 million college grads found jobs. About 2 million were unable to find jobs. So we have some real serious issues out there about what is it that's going on. A lot of it has to do with the quality assessment of these scientists and engineers. We went out and we did over 60 field interviews across some major cities over a couple of years to kind of figure out what is it that's the problem with these college graduates and what is it that people don't like or what is it that their problems are plagued. And basically the quality problems just come about because of simply the education that they're getting is not competent enough to have them meet the requirements in the job market. In China, up until the present, there were very few internships, very few co-ops, very few kind of opportunities for employees and employers, potential employees and employers to kind of meet and understand one another. But the most important question really has to do about whether there exists a kind of culture of creativity that encourages the entrepreneurial, creative, independent thinking kind of behavior of these graduates. First of all, it's not taught in the universities, and second of all, it's not tapped into in terms of the universities themselves. Now, other problems also exist, and I'm going to go through this fast because we don't have a lot of time. One problem has to do with simply the geographic location of people. The Chinese government says, go west, go west, go west, like Horace Greeley. But the problem is the talent is going east, east, east. That is that people simply don't want to be out in these western areas, even though these are potentially the new growth hubs of China. If you look at the talent from 2000 to 2008, the numbers of this is S&T personnel now and who are engaged in R&D, we can see the shift. More people going east and less people wanting to be in the west. If we look at the numbers historically, we can see the concentrations 1998, 2004, 2008, Guangdong, Jiangsu, Beijing, Zhejiang, Shandong. Not surprising. You don't see, for example, in 1998, you saw Sichuan. We don't see Sichuan anymore on the list. So these are problems. So I'm not going to have enough time to do all I wanted to do. So let me do two more things then. One thing is that we built a supply and demand model to look at China's talent situation and to understand, in effect, what is going on. We looked at some 30 variables. We tried to identify which were, in a sense, the key drivers for the sources of demand for this talent that now is becoming more and more requested in the economy. And I should add, the talent is not only requested by multinationals, but increasingly, whereas before local companies and multinationals were competing for different talent pools, increasingly Chinese companies and multinationals are competing for the same talent, that high-end, well-paid, well-prepared talent that is now being entering the job market. So if you look at it, basically we found four variables that were critical. One was investment in R&D. The second was the growth of high value-added high-tech exports. The third was the increasing investment in information technology. And the fourth was the increasing changes in the high value-added nature of foreign investment itself, all of which were providing a demand pull for a higher and higher level of talent into the economy. So let me give you my let me just show you one chart, and I'll close, okay? So if you look at this over time between 1989 and 2020, what you get is you get a changing picture of the talent pool demand function. You see it starts off as largely a supply-driven function, particularly over the 1990s, all the way up until about 2004, where the picture begins to change, and now it becomes much more of a demand-driven. And that's why we see this tremendous huge pull now to bring talent not only from within the economy, but also to bring back talent. China needs mid-level and high-level talent in order to manage and lead and direct all of these people that are now coming back into the economy. If you look at it, it's like a pyramid. The flat end is very full with talent. A lot of fresh graduates, no problem. But the problem is in this mid-level and upper tier where we find the quality people. So let me give you my conclusions because we don't have time for all of this. Too bad. Okay. So what does it all mean? I think that China actually is, and why do we see this big push for talent? China is facing the talent shortage. That talent shortage could have a serious or an even negative impact in the near to medium term on the following things. First of all, it could contribute to the slowing of growth, particularly in terms of these high-tech, technology-intensive sectors, and I think this is one of the problems we see. The medium to long-term S&T plan, and you can describe it as slow out of the gate. In other words, China is not moving fast enough to become an innovative economy. Chinese leaders realize that. They need the kind of talent to be entering into the picture to move the economy along. A really rapid response, I think, is needed to fix this problem. The problem is not just, again, a quantity problem. It's a quality problem. And that quality problem is something that China has a short-term window to deal with, I think. What is important is that this returnee cohort can be quite critical. And I think this is why the 1,000 talent program is so important to China. It could turn out to be a kind of critical catalyst that could actually change the dynamics in a number of these R&D centers. Some of these people will be pulled into foreign R&D centers. Some of them will be pulled into Chinese enterprises. But if the process does indeed work and they do become change agents, we could see a much faster movement in terms of the environment within these R&D centers, within these enterprises. So I think this is going to be very, very critical in the short term to medium term. Over the long term, I agree exactly with what Professor Wong said about this is a software problem, not a hardware problem. That is, are we preparing people in China who can do the following things? Do they have the skills and comfort levels about managing technology in a very fluid, very fast-changing environment? Do they have the skills and comfort levels about managing collaboration in a cross-border, collaborative kind of world? Do they have the kind of comfort levels working outside of traditional Guanxi networks and working outside of traditional ethnic networks? Do they have the ability to stimulate real creativity in an environment where petty jealousy, ad hoc intervention, and even fraud, particularly in the research environment, now is becoming more and more evident? Do they have the ability to educate managers under the present system really who are flexible, who are adaptive problem solvers with a capacity for critical analysis? When you survey the managers, they tell you these are precisely the skills that are missing among the graduates and even among the middle-trained people. And finally, do they have the ability to adopt the kind of open systems approach to innovation and to reduce this kind of baggage of techno-nationalism that Ken Lieberthal referred to this morning? We see some of this behavior still in existence about technical standards. We see China's evidence of this in some of the discussion about indigenous innovation. But in the world of global collaboration in R&D and innovation, the open systems approach is where we're headed. Can China feel comfortable within that? So these are all big questions for China. Ultimately, it's going to have to balance three things: the ability, the creativity needed to become an innovative nation, the stability needed that's associated with a harmonious society, and the openness with a collaborative economy. China has to put all these three things together in order to become a successful economy, particularly in terms of its requirement to become an innovative economy in the future. So thank you very much.
I don't have any PowerPoint presentation. What I wanted to do was to follow up sort of on the remarks of our previous speaker, and my remarks sort of echo much of what he said. I think Professor Wang's presentation, it gave us a very good sort of overview of how China's leadership is beginning to recognize the critical importance of human capital and is sort of moving away from the earlier emphasis on physical capital. It also, I think, at least coming from India, makes one envious of how the leadership of China is so forward-looking and the extraordinary capabilities of like planning which China has. My remarks have been working a fair bit on higher education, and it sort of raises some larger questions. One which has been raised a bit earlier is, what exactly do we mean by the word talent? And what types of higher education foster what types of talents? Is talent creativity? Is talent about skills? I might be a good accountant, but I may not be very creative. In fact, you may not want to have very creative accountants. Enron had creative accountants. You might have very people with good skills in finance. You may not want to have very creative people in finance, as we know now with what Wall Street has done, right? So skills and creativity need not, when you join them, be a very good thing. What do we think about the goals of higher education for any society? And you know, I think China, India are, of course, grappling, but all societies have grappled with them. Do we want them to train people in particular skills, which is what we think about professional education? Or do we want them to make people trainable, right, which is what liberal arts do? Is the goal of higher education to create a middle class, or is it to be a ladder of social mobility, right? or is it to make us better citizens? If we had choices, right, our institutions, would you like to hire someone who is really talented but venal and corrupt, or someone who's not very talented but is reasonably honest? How would you make those choices? Right? There is no guarantee, and I see very little evidence, that people who are highly talented are necessarily more honest, right? At least the evidence is moot. So how do we choose between these two, right? And I want to put that at the back, because I think behind much of our the hoo-ha-ha on higher education is, of course, this whole thing about, well, it's about really science and the technology. I mean, in the end, I think it comes down a lot like to that. Like, look, it's about R&D, patents, papers, publications, X country is doing better than Y, and we should be worried, et cetera, et cetera. But let's say that higher education has multiple goals, and, you know, many of which I've, like, mentioned. You need better skills, perhaps hopefully better citizens, more creativity, so on and so forth. So how do we get there? Right? How do we approach these goals? In a general sort of economic framework, you would say, well, so economies grow. Growth creates its own like demand for particular forms of human capital, and then you have a supply response. Right? You could argue the other way, and I think to some extent, you could see perhaps this happening in China, is basically you actually create large amounts of like supply. Supply can create its own like demand, the usual, you know, Say's laws. A different way, which I think is a lot of what actually has happened in China and India, is you begin at the selection process, right? Both countries have, at the end of high school, a really Darwinian system of exams, right? Japan also had that. It's a sort of Asian way, if you want to call it, right? So you have millions of students, tens of millions taking these exams. It's a Darwinian process. The top 0.1, 0.3, 0.5% will go to the top universities, right? And that's what makes those universities good, not because they necessarily have great faculty, et cetera, but they have students who are very, very smart, have a habit of working very, very hard. Now, the irony is we actually don't have evidence of this in this country as well. If you ask this question, do Harvard Business School students do well because of the selection process or because of the value added by faculty? HBS has no incentive to do a study on that. And I can guarantee you no elite institution, and I've been in all of them, has any incentive to do any study of the value added which we actually add, because it might raise questions of the $200,000 which we charge you on. So there actually is, you know, it's surprising. At higher education, we look and how everyone else, cost-benefit analysis, what is the value added. It's very hard to show, right? It's very hard to show is a Princeton education. How do we know it's not the selection process of getting into Princeton that really was the value added? After that, you know, you leave bright people alone, they'll manage. So that's one thing, right? In fact, but that very selection process, you know, these pressure cooker exams are actually, you could argue, also stifle actually creativity. You know, that's the, so in higher education, you'll see, as I'm going to say, all of these have the trade-offs. You know, you get one which works, you get this selection process, but then Bill Gates dropped out of like Harvard, right? You could argue if he had stayed on, what would he have done, right? Now, China's, you know, sort of fantastic rise, we know, has been driven largely by like manufacturing. And there's been a parallel sort of increase in recent years, and that's what the data shows, which is a very rapid sort of expansion of higher education. This has also been the case like with India as well. Now, you know, an expansion of manufacturing and higher education are actually two very, very different things. If you ask this question, in the last, since World War II, in the United States, of the top 50 universities, how many universities were created after World War II? Right? I mean, if you ask this question. And it's actually, apparently, well, if you believe these rankings, and, you know, you take it with a pinch of salt, but apparently there's just one, and that's like UC San Diego. And it just shows that one of the things is, why do we think of the Oxfords or Harvards, et cetera? All of these are very old institutions, right? And that's one thing. It's not like manufacturing where you start expand like rapidly, right? One of the reasons that Princeton and Harvards are great universities is they have not expanded at all, right? The stark difference between higher education and firms in the private sector is firms, you are good, you expand. If you don't expand, that's it. In higher education, it's exactly the opposite. You actually control yourself, right? And it's like the Hermes brand. It's the few number that gives you the extra brand value, right? But we have a problem here, right? That we are seeing in these countries, a very, very rapid expansion, right? Now, when you expand higher education, what do you do? Well, the easy part, particularly I think in China, is the physical part, right? Just build. Second part, which is also easy, is to attract students, because the base secondary education is a very deep, large pool, which has been growing. But then, of course, the third, and this is the one that is perennially all over the world, is everywhere, it's important, which is who will teach them, right, which is the faculty problem. And this is a massive problem globally. I think the real problem globally in higher education everywhere, where it's expanding in Asia, et cetera, is who will teach them. Now imagine if you are a talented person now in China and India, right, where there is seriously demand, market-like demand for your skills. Well, the markets now are paying you 5 to 10 times where compared to what you would make as a faculty member. In India, and I, by no means I should extend this to China, the Delhi School of Economics used to be one of the world's, you know, actually leading schools in the 1950s and 60s. It's virtually the only one in India that produces PhDs that are, you know, of reasonable global standards. And the total number it produces a year for a country of 1.1 billion is 1.2, right? Because if you are talented with a master's, you get jobs that pay you 10 times as much in the financial sector. It's also a thing where you ask this question when we think about engineers. If you ask this question, when we think of MIT, we think of it as a great engineering school, right? And everyone all over the world wants to replicate MIT, right? I mean, that's your engineering, MIT. Well, 40% of MIT's alumni or graduates go to finance and consulting, not to engineering, right? All the Ivy Leagues, their engineering graduates, go, about half go to consulting and investment banking or finance, basically, right? So here you have great engineering schools. The output, by the way, is not in engineering. In fact, if you look at the Ivy League, virtually no one in the Ivy Leagues ever goes to a manufacturing company now. That's long gone. It's the Penn States, right, which supply for man. It's too dirty. So elites, the more elitist a system you create, it's not clear to where that talent is likely to go. You think you are creating engineers. They don't end up in engineering, right? So there is this thing that what you think you are doing and what actually ends up, there can be a total mismatch. The other thing which is, I think, happening, which was raised in the last point, is that in China, with this rapid expansion of faculty, has been there's a bit of a pressure cooker in terms of trying to show that that the publications, the output has been rising. And one of the things which is very unfortunate, but which is the least worst option we have, is we all want indicators that we can measure. Right, so you want to see publications is one. It's actually quite extraordinary the degree of scientific fraud that is happening, like from China. I mean, I've been amazed in the last week because of this invitation in looking at how many major international journals have actually asked their very significant numbers of papers from China. They've actually taken them out because the results have not been replicated. They cannot replicate, which is actually really very, very rare in major science journals. And it's creating a terrible negative reputation when I've talked to the editors of major science journals. You know, what happens is now everyone gets far more careful when you look at it. And that's basically because the pressure within China that you must publish to get ahead is so hard. I mean, it's so much. And as I said, when you try and compress long historical processes in very short time periods, we just don't know what sorts of things sort of happen. Now, a different way we might think of talent is not the usual way, which is, top level like universities, but to think about skills, right? Especially what I think are medium level skills, right? For the labor market, but a higher value added like labor market. Now, for instance, let's say your goal is you want talent to improve your health sector, right? So you think, well, what do you need? You need doctors, which is a usual thing. You need nurses. And we think of doctors, we think of Harvard Medical School. Ah, that's our goal. It's not really clear if you look at the mess in U.S. Healthcare, if that's what you want to address, that you want to invest more in Harvard Medical School, right? There are 50 other things which will give you far bigger bang for the buck. Public health actually gives you far bigger bang for the buck in most countries and doesn't require fantastic talent in a sense, right? In fact, in most countries now, if you want to invest, you don't want to invest actually in these top-rated schools of medicine, which are extremely expensive to run. But actually, you might want to invest much more in medical technician training. The people who operate the X-ray machines, the host of instrumentation that now underlies the testing equipment, all of that. That's not super training, but you require a 1 year good, 2 years good training after high school, and you can get a very good cadre of the technicians. But it's not the sexy area, right? We all want to replicate MIT and Caltech and Harvard. These are not things, frankly, that get that much attention. That skill is, frankly, less coming from the state because it's not coming. Elites don't care about these things. That is actually coming more from the private sector, right? Because the private sector is what is expanding, at least in India, and that is what is supplying that training. So if you look at, for India, for instance, India's largest investments in higher education in single campuses are actually coming from firms. So if you look at Infosys, which is one of India's leading IT companies, it relies that, look, India produces engineers roughly on the same scale as China. Like China, barely a quarter are employable, right, because most of them are very poorly trained. So what does a company like Infosys do? It has created capabilities to actually hire more than 10,000 people a year and train them. So every year, every day, actually, Infosys gives an exam to 1,000 people, 1 million a year, right? One company gives exams to 1 million people, selects 10,000. Usual Darwinian process, you select at in any curve at the top 1%, it'd be reasonably bright people in any distribution. Then it's created a campus, it's invested almost $500 million in a campus, and it trains them in actually domain knowledge. So you think these people have not been taught well, they're reasonably bright. And when we looked at some of the results of who takes the exams and how well they do, faculty from these engineering schools where these students are taking the exam also are taking these exams because the faculty are very poorly paid and would desperately want to work in Infosys rather than teach. Well, the success rate of students is 1%. The success rate of faculty is 0.1%, right? So you can imagine the quality of teaching that is sort of going on. And I think this medium level skills, at least I find countries like Finland or Germany, which have very strong links between firms, labor markets, and this medium level skills, has been a very important part why these countries, I think, have to develop skilled labor markets, but don't have as much of the brand name higher education institutions. I think in addition to training programs, one of the things which I'm looking at least in the Indian case, there's an important organizational innovation that came about in the 19th century, which we don't focus on as much, which is particularly true for training and standards, and that's the professional organizations, right? The lawyers, the doctors, right? The AMA, the CPAs, right? All these professional organizations, what they do is they set standards, right? They conduct exams, and hopefully, to some extent at least, they try and maintain professional set of ethics and so on and so forth. I think to understand the role that these professional organizations have placed and how they could play a much greater role, I think that to an extent, of course, these are core parts of civil society that often are, though not necessarily, are independent of the state. I'm not quite sure of their status in China, but it might be interesting to see the role that they are playing in improving standards of the professions. Two more points, and then I'll finish. One is attracting overseas talent. I've just finished a book on that in the Indian case and looked around it so elsewhere. Most developing countries have tried these programs. Most have failed rather miserably. But then, in a sense, almost anything you say about developing countries, China is the exception. So one cannot at all draw anything about it, with respect to China, because when it goes, as the example is, they do succeed. But I think one of the things is, what is interesting is that not only have they failed in developing countries, but they have also failed in many rich countries. The EU and Japan have tried, everyone has tried to replicate what the US has done. And actually the success rate has been much, much lower, right? I mean, the EU and Japan have tried to attract using things by looking at the number of Indians who come to the US in Silicon Valley to try and replicate that. Very few Indians go to Europe and to Japan. And language is one issue, but that's only a small issue, I think. And the question is why, right? So how, when you think of attracting talent, right, you usually we think of giving them resources. I'll give you a great science lab, give you a $1 million startup money, that's the sort of thing you think about. One other thing is that I think is that when you go to any country, your success is not just your own personal skills, but also how in a sense, societies react to, if you want to call it, like foreigners, right? How open are they? And I think there's no doubt that the U.S. in this respect is an outlier, And I think we should acknowledge that in a way that makes, that is a distinctive strength in a way that is just not true of Japan, somewhat true of Anglo-Saxon countries, and less true of continental, Europe. And I think, 2 minutes? one. Okay. And that's the thing which, you know, it's hard, like, for me to say, because I don't think so. I understand China that well to be able to predict, but I suspect it will not be easy. The final point, which is something I think we've not talked about. What are the political implications of creating a society with lots of talent? Right. Well, talent, you know, you've got to be creative. I mean, look, in the end, right, you want people to be creative. And what is the fundamental bottom line of creative people? They think independently. If you can't think independently, I don't see how you can be creative. Right? And if you are going to think independently, why do you think that you're going to think independently and creatively only about how to create the next, you know, iPad and not about politics or about like, social change? And I suspect that China will be faced with this conundrum. The more it wants a more creative society, the more it will face a singular threat to its to the political monopoly of the Communist Party. Thanks.
Okay, we have probably half an hour. We will open floor just in a few minutes. But let me start the first round of questions for each of the panelists. And first of all, the excellent presentation, really complements to each other. The first question is for Dr. Wang, that you mentioned that 500 meetings, a lot of discussions among the leadership or scholars about the national plan, the talent plan. Now, what's the most controversial issue in this preparation process? And also related to that question is the fact that the person pushed for the talent plan, Minister Li Yuanchao, is also a person pushing for China's political reform. Now, do you see there's a connection between these two? Could a lack of political reform or the China's political system, you know, lack of competitive political system, is a bottleneck for recruiting talent? Now, this is my question for you. Now, Maybe I should finish the question, then you can answer. For Dennis, I think you did an excellent job to talk about the lack of height and of talent pool and also the quantity versus quality. As you also know very well, that China actually was a leader in the most centuries of the last millennium and in science and technology. And China declined because of later historian at Oxford, Joseph Needham, described as the Needham paradox. His explanation is because the regime discriminate technical people and discriminate entrepreneurship. That caused the decline of China. But now you see this kind of China's, you know, the government or parties really emphasize on science and technology. And the entrepreneurship also reemerged in the country. Now, my question is that it's a simple one. Can the 21st century's Einstein or Edison be a PRC national? You know, give me the simple answer, yes or no, and why. And for Dalish, I think that your criticism of China's, you know, the state-run, you know, drive recruitment, it's a very very thoughtful and well-grounded, and also some other issues. And sometimes I wonder why China need have such a huge pull and what's the political implication. Now, here's my question. Is there anything, based on Professor Wang's presentation, based on your knowledge of China, that India and the United States can learn from China? Now, for the past 30 years, basically China learned from the West, to a certain extent, also learn from India, particularly the software industry. Now, the question is whether U.S. and India could really benefit by learning China. Now, these are three questions.
Good.
Thank you, Chen. It's a good question. Actually, talk about controversial issue in terms of planning this this talent plan. There's many of them, actually. There's one, first of all, how to define the talents. It's a huge task for all the people that are involved in the process.
But the most controversial issue, not this concept, could be really mm-hmm. not so meaningful. Yeah.
Sure. Well, one of the controversial issues is about whether we should add some social, social professionals, and then people in the scholar fields, in the science, in the philosophy, humanities, and those areas. And actually, initially there was no such a category, and then in the end they added that into one of the categories. In the sixth category, there was one category added about social workers, and also added about the. People that look in the science, in social science and humanities. So I think that was really a breakthrough, because in the past there was always emphasized on science and technology, but yet we know that we need social science, we need the humanities, we need management. So I think this is a breakthrough there. And then the second you talk about with the political system and then the talent plan connections. Well, I think this is a really fundamental that we need to have a change of the talent to start the momentum. And that really will gradually, I think, get into the political system as this is going on. Because when you have one of the examples I was giving in the presentation is that out of the Southern Talent Program, 300 people that recruited recently has been put into the party school, where the party school used to teach only the CPP parties. And now you have the international talents. 80% of them are international passport holders getting into the senior party school and then being orientated at the different programs. And then that's really itself is a breakthrough. So that means the party school has shifted away from educating parties and then now become attracting all the international talents to change within the party. So that really is something I think that never has been evident in the past. So I think those are quite interesting phenomena, and that we're going to change in the long run. For example, also in the past, foreign nationals cannot apply for the membership of a Chinese Social Science Academy, cannot be the academy of the Science Academy or Engineering Academy. Now, with the Southern Talent Program, it sets the examples for all the rest of the provinces and then has break all the traditional taboos and of not to. Yeah.
Thank you.
I would just like to ask one question to Professor Wang, and that's why do they have to even go to the party school?
Yeah. Well, basically, what is for those people coming back, then they have to know the system. So they have actually invited a number of ministers to give the talks about, for example, they invited people from State Planning Commission, Minister of Education, Minister of Science and Technology, and Minister of course, the Yuan Chao himself gave some talks. So that really. To show that there's and imagine the foreigners sitting in the party school and then getting to know the domestic inner system, that really going to make a lot of interface, a lot of clashes too, but then eventually make some changes.
I definitely no doubt there can be an Einstein or an Edison coming from China. There is no cultural reason, there is no ethnic reason, there is no reason from that perspective of why we cannot see whether it's the next Nobel Prize winner or a great thinker of the world coming from within China. I don't think that's the problem. The problem is the institutional setting in which the person is evolved. That is that where that person's career trajectory takes them, will it be inside, in a sense, formal organizations that already exist, or will it be outside the system? Because as the system is currently configured, there are too many internal constraints that it would allow a person to basically just kind of freely, break out of the box. That's why I think that this imbalance between harmonious society and innovative nation is such a big problem. Because in many ways, you don't see Hu Jintao talking about those at the same time. To foment a harmonious nation means you got to go with the flow. It means kind of follow the norm, stay in line, go straight ahead. If you talk about innovative nation, it means break with the pact, go upstream, go in a different direction. How can you balance, in a sense, what you want out of a harmonious society with an innovative nation? That's the institutional context in which this Einstein would have to make, you know, survive and prosper. I think it can be done because individuals like Einstein and Edison are so unique. They're even unique in the American system, for that matter. But in China, I think it would be a tall order to see many Einsteins and many Edisons, I think. Yeah. Now, if this reform goes ahead, and I think a lot of these improvements occur, the chances increase. And I think that's what Liu and Chao's actually mandate really is to open up the parameters of these organizations and to use these 1,000 or 2,000 people as catalysts to bring about changes in the operating environment so Einsteins and Edisons, et cetera, can prosper.
Thank you.
Ironically, I think both the U.S. and India can learn about certain politics, like from China. One, I think the U.S. can learn from China, which is a shared view of elites about a vision like for the country. I think it's really amazing that the U.S. now has such a poisonous atmosphere across political elites about what is the future of the country, what is their vision. And I think China, yes, there are, we know, you know, behind this, I'm sure there are lots of factions and discussions and debates. But I think nothing like what we see now, at least sort of in the U.S. I think that is definitely something the U.S. can learn from China. If elites of a country don't have a shared vision for the future, it's hard for me to see how that country can go anywhere. I mean, with their problems. I think India can learn. India can learn a lot from China. But just one I'll emphasize, which is about political parties. You know, it's ironic that the Chinese Communist Party is a much more meritocratic, it's not wholly meritocratic, you know, but relatively much more meritocratic political party than, and in an authoritarian system than any of India's political parties in sort of democratic India. India's political parties are largely like family-owned fiefdoms, you know, businesses, very authoritarian. It's such an irony in that sense that in a authoritarian system, you have a relatively more open democratic political party, but in a democracy, you have exactly the opposite.
Very interesting answers. So I don't want to add the comments, just leave it for open. And please identify yourself and also limit your question to one, and also address to whom in the panel you wanted to ask. Tom? Do you want a microphone? Yeah. Please also tell the audience.
Tom Friedman from the New York Times. Dennis, I want to pick up with where you ended on this kind of contradiction and that really ran through the panel, which was fantastic. So I think of sort of four, I'd like you to comment on this, sort of four contradictions I see. China, first of all, has got to get rich before it gets old. Okay, clearly it's got this aging problem. To get rich, you got to move from a less assembly economy to a more knowledge economy based on talent, like you're talking about. To have a knowledge economy today, you need to move to this platform of this sort of horizontal platform, which is going to be based on Facebook and Twitter, and of basically using all the dots on the board and how to assemble them. It requires a lot of openness. It requires Google, Facebook, and Twitter. I believe all three have been banned in China. Google has been banned, but you know what I mean. And at the same time, to open up to Twitter, at a time when you're making this transition, you have these huge income gaps. And one thing I think the government's deeply worried about is these income gaps. Now imagine if every one of those farmers, 700 million farmers, were tweeting every day. Okay. So it seems to me this is their core dilemma. They've got to get rich before they get poor. To get poor, you've got to move to the new open platform you've talked about. The new open platform creates an openness for all kinds of social dissent, and that dissent threatens the system. That somewhere in that loop, to me, they have a fundamental problem.
Add one more element to it, and that is that if you have every year several million college graduates who are, in effect, IT comfortable and actually do know the technology and actually can have the capability to beat the controls on the IT system, internet, and they are disaffected because they've been met with high expectations. Their parents have been given expectations that their children would, by going to these schools, would be successful. And now all of a sudden they become disillusioned. They represent, in a sense, a vanguard because they are perhaps more globally connected, more cosmopolitan in some cases, and therefore more able to mobilize. I think that it's probably more frightening when you look out. Sure, sheer numbers, you don't want 700 million peasants to have Twitter. But in terms of really being able to mobilize, think about, you know, 8 or 10 million disaffected college students who simply have had unsuccessful efforts to find jobs or found jobs. For example, increasingly, they're being asked to go out to the rural areas to serve in local level posts in a kind of 2-3 year holding pattern with the hope that eventually, as the drivers that I've talked about begin to materialize, they'll find the kind of Silicon Valley job that they hope. But in the short term, if that doesn't happen, short to medium term, their impatience will grow. I think that's the real danger point in the short term.
You see now, you talk about the problem that there's 700 million farmers, but actually there's 200 million migrant workers that are really, floating around in China. And then by 2020, according to this plan, China is going to have almost 200 million college graduates among the population. And they will be familiar with those high tech and all those gadgets and all those communication skills. And that will bring to China enormous changes. And then that's really the challenge the government is facing right now, how to handle that. And this talent plan is exactly, ahead of time to really think about those issues and trying to tackle the issues that you talk about.
Thank you. Holly?
Thank you. I'm Harley Balzer from Georgetown University, and I'd like to ask Professor Simon and Professor Kapoor in particular to talk a little bit about comparative perspective on this. I mean, if we think about China compared to Germany or the United States, looks like a very steep mountain to climb. If we look at it compared to India, Brazil, Russia, they don't seem to be doing so badly. Okay.
I think when you put, and Devash can answer as well, but I think if you look at put it into comparison to the BRICS countries, generally speaking, China is in a much better position. It has a fairly fast-moving educational sector that is developing rather rapidly. And I don't think the metric necessarily is or the benchmark is only the United States or the OECD countries. I think that China, in fact, what we've started to find is that there may be a kind of a Chinese way of innovation. And I'll give you a good example. GE recently in GE's lab developed a brand new MRI machine that usually in the United States sells for several hundred thousands of dollars. But they've been able to find and develop one in the Chinese market for somewhere about $25,000. And because of that, now they've been able to take that same kind of a device and sell that all around the world into what I would call these intermediate zone markets. That is a whole series of countries that may not be able to afford $250,000, types of machinery like that, but they can afford $25,000. And most important, these are mobile devices. That is that they can be moved around, and they're also built with the idea that they're going to be in rough and tumble environments so that they don't have the sensitivity and the kind of problems that a lot of the equipment might have if they simply brought it over from the United States, which operates in very clean environments. So my sense is that the potential, it's a little bit C.K. Prahalad's kind of from the bottom up idea, that the potential for a kind of new wave of innovation, given the base that exists in China, frankly, is huge. The question is, can they marshal that? And I think, a lot of people have been talking about China's kind of ego lately, but I think there's also a great deal of anxiety in China. And I think that anxiety is that they're looking at the global technological revolution moving very quickly. They're looking at new energy products being developed. They're looking at the life science revolution. I think there's a great deal of anxiety among Chinese leaders that, frankly, the innovation drive is not moving fast enough. And I think that's what really worries people in China. That's really what's on the minds of the leaders.
Just for comparative purposes, I mean, in the Indian case, because the state is much weaker compared to China, the real driver is the private sector, whether it is innovation and also sort of higher education. It's much less centrally organized. It's much more decentralized. Brick and mortar, like universities, the way we normally think of the universities, most students are enrolled, but that's not where the learning takes place. The learning takes place in a host of enormous numbers of private institutions whether they are learning English or C++ programming or whatever, or, you know, so on and so forth. I think the nature of, and what you are seeing, I mean, one, in a sense, India is now a nation of sort of hustlers. Everyone is out trying to make a buck, and when everyone is out trying to make a buck, you see fantastic creativity and innovation with millions of problems that come about when everyone is trying to make a buck.
Yeah, in the back, the lady from Singapore, right?
Actually from China.
Okay, sure. Sorry.
Xiong Ming with the 21st Century Business Herald. This is a newspaper in China. My question is to Professor Simon. One thing I'm curious about is whether such vigorous national talent attraction plan from the Chinese government is, do you see is posing kind of threat to the U.S.? The reason I ask is because, you know, we have to admit that China is trying to attract the best talent from the world, including the U.S. Do you see such a threat? And based on your knowledge with the corporate world as well as the political decision makers in the U.S., do you see they recognize such implications and whether they are thinking about how to address such a, you know, such a new policy? Thank you.
It's a really good question. Without mentioning the names of universities, but I'll give you an example. In some discussions I've had with senior university leaders among a number of universities here in the United States, they actually are all sitting down and discussing, in a sense, about the potential impact to their faculty on these 1,000 talent program. Is it a national security threat? No. But is it a threat to some departments within key universities in the United States? No doubt. The chance or the potential to lose two or three senior professors who are established or bringing in research dollars, and potentially that those people could move back. Now, there is you know, the phenomena of, I guess, what do they call them, seagull now? Yeah, they get kind of, you know, foot in the U.S. and foot in China. But there's a second problem with that, and that problem has to do with intellectual property. And that is that, in effect, with floating kind of intellectual property, the way that we use it now and the way we treat it and manage it now, it's very problematic about who owns the intellectual property that, for example, starts to embryonically get developed, let's say, in a U.S. university, and given the U.S. university's grab on some of that, how easily can that move then to a Chinese university, and then who owns that? And what about the Chinese universities? So a lot of the biggest difficulties right now are when this kind of collaboration starts to occur because of these professors who are highly mobile. The universities now don't want to interrupt the innovation, but on the other hand, they also don't want to lose out if, in fact, something becomes commercializably, you know, valuable. So they're trying to now come into what kind of agreements are needed and what kind of collaborative, you know, all kinds of different agreements that they're looking at. So I think, you know, there is an issue. I don't think it's at the level of the country, but I think if you look at particular universities, they would tell you they're very concerned about the potential impact. And that would also be the case for any kind of reverse brain drain that would occur. I think there's discussions about India that are going on as well, about Indian scholars who may return, and Korean scholars who over the last recent years also have. So China probably, again, because it's China, big in number, but I think that it's still, the impact is potentially going to be problematic for some institutions.
But maybe I could add on that. Actually, the number of senior high-level people going back to China is still very limited. It's about 8% in terms of people getting PhDs. And then in terms of China coming here, it's about the Peking University and Tsinghua University are ranked number one and number two in terms of supply PhD candidates. So I think on the long run, U.S. is still benefiting.
We'll probably take a few questions, and because we have limited time. Yes, please. You. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm Kathleen Newland, director of the Migration Policy Institute here in Washington. And it's difficult to address my question to one of the panelists because it's sort of cumulative as a result of listening to all three, but I think to Dr. Wang probably. It sounds really almost as if the talent program is attempting to create a culture within a culture in China. And I wonder if both you and your colleagues on the panel think that that really is possible in the long term. It's particularly relevant for attracting overseas talent, both overseas Chinese, both Chinese diaspora and foreigners, if the broader culture has not adapted as well to this sort of subculture that's trying to nurture innovation. But it also seems to me that it has great bearing on the longer-term political issue of support for this kind of big national program.
Yeah, please, gentlemen. Thank you for your patience. Yeah,
thank you. Chia Chen, freelance correspondent, bassist, man. This question is to Dr. Wang. If this project in Chinese is Zencai, then I think the translation lost the meaning. Mm-hmm. And if in Chinese is Tiancai, I think should change to Zencai. And also, how much is the emphasis on the area of public health? Because this is very important for the sustainability in China. Thank you.
Okay, probably last question. Yes, this gentleman. Yeah.
Hi, I'm John Exley. I'm a student at American University and also a blogger. I like to read about technology and web startups. So my question is, in the U.S., we attract a lot of the talent in Silicon Valley for the tech entrepreneurs, but it's very difficult for Europeans and Asians to get a visa to come here and start their companies. So my question is, what is China doing to make it easier for entrepreneurs outside of China to come in and start companies? And also, what specifically are they doing for entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs like me in China to start their companies? Are they giving investments from the government, et cetera?
Yeah, is there any question about India?
Yeah.
Okay, yes, please, the last one, yeah.
Hi, I'm Dalal Haider. I'm also from American University. So to Mr. Wang, one of your...
The question is about India, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
India. One of the transformations you were talking about is from hardware to software. And right now, China is mainly known as its economy is mainly dependent on manufacturing, whereas India is on its services. So you can say that China is basically about hardware, whereas India is about its software. So would this transformation from hardware to software have any impact on China's relationship with India? Mm-hmm. With it?
So yeah, please answer them together. Yes.
Sure. Yeah, thank you for all the good questions. And I think the first question, talking about the culture, I think that's really precisely this talent plan is trying to do about. Because as I mentioned, that there's a number of people coming back. When that critical mass is created, then there's a lot of implications for all the other sectors and all the other provincials. So the central, for example, the central government launched this Stolen Talent Program. After that, 10 provincial government launched their own Stolen Talent Program. So add them up, it's 10,000 programs. So it's really, it's creating a culture, we're creating a lot of changes within that program. So that is really happening. And I'm talking about the talent the definition. I think that's right, because it'll be broadly used in Chinese terms. I think that really refers to people who had education, who had some experience, and who can do some creative work. It's not in a talent sense here, but then in the Chinese situation, it means people who can make some contribution to the society. So I think if a culture is created that respect the talent, respect the people with knowledge, and respect people with expertise, that really going to change China. I think that's really it's a good sign. And so it comes to the question that you have about entrepreneurs. That's right, because in the Silicon Valley, there's about 50% of the entrepreneurs are out of China and India, and China is really having a lot of students coming to the United States. For example, there's about 200,000 people coming out of China last year in terms of coming to overseas to study. And then this year going to be 300,000. So that momentum is there. And a lot of entrepreneurs were coming out of the people who come to the U.S. and study here. Now the question is for the indigenous, local Chinese entrepreneurs, how can they come out? So there could be some visa issues and also the investment climate in the U.S. where they are welcomed here. So that's why we are proposing maybe to do an investment seminars or conference in the U.S. to attract Chinese investment. And that's going to help addressing the RMB issues and trade imbalance issues, and in the long run. And then finally, talking about the the Indian, you know, comparison. That's precisely, China was thriving for the past 30 years basically on the manufacturing basis. Yet I was talking about that. You know, they have created the 220 million migrant workers out of that manufacturing. Now China has about 200 million the college graduates by the time of 2020, and then China's service industry is only 40% of China's GDP. And that's going to have an enormous problem because that's where the sector is going to absorb the college graduates. So I think that in the next 10 years, China is going to have to catch up on the service sectors, which you mentioned about Indian situation. So I think that's probably complementary to each other. While China catch up on the service industry, India probably could catch up on the manufacturing side, where that because the labor cost in China is getting higher and a lot of manufacturing may shift to India and a lot of service jobs may come to China, so that will create a balanced Indian, you know, China situation. So that's my answer.
You say 40%? 40%, yeah. 40%.
Yeah, but whereas in Hong Kong it's 96%. Yeah. So you see that's really the problem that China having right now.
Yeah. Just the point which you, Kathleen, raised on the culture within a culture, which I think is very well put. Where I think it's a conscious strategy is of the Indian private sector. We've just done a large survey of the biotech and the pharma sector in India, and they are actually developing a strategy whereby to attract the talent back. But, you know, if you create a lab with only overseas talent, of course you lose your costs because it's very high cost then. So the strategy is that the lab head is from overseas, and then he or she then trains lower cost but lesser talent from Indian universities and also creates a work culture that replicates a work culture here. And that's a strategy that a number of India leading pharma and biotech firms are trying to adopt.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, I just to add to that, if you look at in China now, there are some 1,250 foreign R&D centers that have been built. And when you look at the reason why, for example, a Chinese who's gone to graduate school in the U.S. goes back to work for GE or IBM in China, one of the reasons they go, the salary is not actually, the differential is not huge anymore. In fact, the salary pretty much is comparable. They go for the work environment. And the most important thing about that work environment, the kind of guanxi, the relationship culture that exists inside Chinese organizations does not exist in the achievement-oriented kind of culture in these R&D centers in China. And that now has led to a kind of internal brain drain in China. People go back, but they go back to work for foreign companies inside of China. And there is some concern about that. Now, over the last year, because of the financial crisis, there's been some movement to state-owned enterprises. And there's been actually a larger number of people who are saying, we'll work for Chinese state-owned enterprises. It's more stable. If I go to work for Google, maybe I'll lose my job or something like that. But still, at the same time, they still feel much more comfortable in these work environments inside the multinationals in China. And that's something that is of concern to people, particularly in the places like the Ministry of Science and Technology, Chinese Academy of Sciences, which are looking to basically draw people into their own environments and to work there and to drive those innovation efforts.
Well, this is the second event within half a year about the human resources, talent, and et cetera. And the first one was about retainees and their impact for China's transformation. This is one about the talent. I think probably at least we should do another one, maybe invite people like Tom Friedman to speak. You really should speak for this event. You know, you're the leading expert on that that issue, the flow of international talent. Maybe we can talk about the seagulls and et cetera. And yes. And also that the transcripts will be available in a few days. And also Dr. Wang's the PowerPoint will be available right very soon. And I don't know whether you will give the embargo or not, whatever. So it will be available online. And we have tremendous interest, excellent questions. And I want the audience to join me to thank for the very stimulating presentations. Thank you very much.